Welcome to Choate Holland Stewart's Cross-Border IP Issues podcast series, focused on highlighting a variety of legal and business considerations for companies considering international expansion or doing a deal with a company that is based in another nation.
This is part two in our cross-border series, where we focus on issues that can arise when commercial ventures enter the U.S. or go outside of the U.S. In part one, we covered some territorial and timing considerations relating to patent rights. And today we'll talk about some important issues related to patent enforcement, validity, and ownership, as well as IP-related transactions. My name is John Rierich. I'm a partner in the intellectual property group at Choate Holland Stewart in Boston. And my practice focuses on patent protection of small molecules at both early and clinical stages of drug development, as well as IP diligence for investor clientele. I'm here with my partner, Brian Reese, who is a co-chair of the IP practice at Choate, specializing in IP issues in the biotech and medical device spaces, including IP-related transactions. So Brian, let's start today with patent enforcement. What are some ways this differs across jurisdictions?
Thanks, John. Yeah, this is a very important issue that we find clients really wrestle with at various points in trying to commercialize therapeutics in particular. So the first thing to remember is that though you're hopefully familiar, maybe not too familiar, with the enforcement of patent rights in your particular jurisdiction, be that the U.S. or wherever else you may be based, enforcement procedures and requirements, outcomes, timing, all of that really varies across different jurisdictions. There are some classic examples, such as in Germany, the discovery procedures are very different than in the United States, where we have very liberal and very deep discovery. In addition, in Germany, the actual procedures to determine patent infringement and patent validity are bifurcated. That is very different than in the U.S., where everything is sort of rolled into one process. In addition, as you very likely heard, the UPC is coming into force in Europe, and so that really sets up a brand new court system that is completely untested at this point. So there are a lot of unknowns out there, and it pays for clients to be mindful of these differences, not necessarily worry about them up front, but to consider it as the entity is growing, as deals are considered, which we'll talk a little bit about later, and just know things are different. And this ties back to session one, where we talked a little bit about where your product is flowing and just the business model in general. IP really needs to be supportive of that, and you need to keep in mind some interesting features of enforcement. Just tying back to session one again, very briefly, there are differences in patentable subject matter, whether that's composition of matter coverage, methods of treatment, and other method claims which are particularly problematic in certain jurisdictions. So it's not only the court systems and the process of enforcing your patents, but actually what you're enforcing can be very, very different. So it's important to keep that in mind as well as, of course, damages, the ability to get injunctions or stop a competitor from selling product. All of those things can really vary considerably. In addition to enforcement, another feature you need to keep in mind is the term of a patent. So as you're all likely aware, patents are finite things. They're assets that exist for a period of time, and then they go away. And the general rule and the assumption for the purposes of this session are that a patent term is about 20 years. And we say that, but some countries have extensions, and the extensions can take different forms across different jurisdictions. So in the United States, when we're talking about patents in particular, you have patent term adjustment and patent term extension that are the two major mechanisms by which you can extend the patent's term. In Europe, there are special protection certificates, and there are other forms of potential extension in different jurisdictions. Now, it's important to keep in mind that what you're able to enforce changes during these time periods, or can, right? So when you extend the term of a patent, potentially the scope of the coverage is different than the granted or issued claims. And so that's something else you want to keep in mind as well. Even if the patent is technically still in force, if that's via one of these extension mechanisms, what you can enforce and how broadly may be a little bit different. Now, in addition to enforcement, the methods of challenging potentially problematic patents can also vary across jurisdictions. And John, I know you have particular expertise here. Do you mind giving us a few things to keep in mind?
Sure, Brian, that's right. There are some variations in the U.S. In addition to, I think what everybody knows, we have a very robust patent litigation system. We also have a method of challenging issued patents before the USPTO, and specifically in proceedings before what's called the Patent Trial and Appeal Board. Now, this is one option that's really only been around about 10 years, but actually harmonizes us a bit with some other countries, in particular Europe. And this option of challenging patents before the patent office is particularly popular in the tech sector. I think something like 80% of the patent challenges here are in the tech realm. Here at CHOAT, though, we've actually handled many in the life sciences on both the biotech and the pharmaceutical chemistry sides. And basically what happens here is that you're asking the patent office to reconsider issued claims based on a variety of different grounds, but typically involving some prior art that was not considered by the examiner during examination of the patent, or maybe it wasn't properly considered. In the US, we do have the advantage here of there being what's called administrative patent judges who are mostly subject matter experts in these fields of the patents that are being challenged. And that can be very helpful because it really can get into the weeds with some of the technical details. There's also a very limited discovery, and this process takes no more than 18 months from beginning to end. Now, there are surely other jurisdictions that have very similar sorts of proceedings. Europe, for example, and other jurisdictions outside of the US, they call these different things. There's a lot of different flavors of them. Sometimes they're called oppositions. Sometimes they're called cancellation proceedings. Sometimes they are done just between the patent owner and the patent office. Sometimes they're between parties. And these can result in a decision of invalidity in the end, if that's what the trier of fact in those particular cases has decided. In general, these administrative proceedings cost much less than litigation, but you do have to consider that appeals can drag on for quite some time before reaching finality in the case. Of course, usually the party enforcing and defending patents in these types of proceedings is the party with ownership of the patents. This is an important topic that sometimes gets taken for granted, but unforced errors relating to ownership can create headaches down the road. For example, when doing IP-related transactions, which we're going to talk more about shortly. But before we get to that, Brian, what are some considerations relating to ownership of IP?
Thanks, John. Yeah, I think this is maybe a pet subject for many patent practitioners, right? So in many jurisdictions, ownership of a patent application begins with the inventors, absent some contract to contrary effect. And this can be an employment agreement in certain jurisdictions. With related to assignments in particular, the actual documents, the mechanics of it, in the US, we're fairly permissible, right? So we need to transfer ownership of, in many cases, the invention, not necessarily just the applications, because sometimes applications are deemed to include more than one invention. And we allow inventors and assignees or corporate owners, usually the employer, to get electronic signature on many documents. And mostly in the US, you can use electronic documents on your assignments. Or like DocuSign, for instance. That's a very common mechanism. This is not the case outside the US. And so just the mechanics of the actual assignment itself do vary. So electronic, very convenient in these days of remote work, but may not be legally sufficient, particularly in Europe and other jurisdictions. In addition, just simply how do you sign the thing? Other countries have certain other requirements, such as they need notarization or legalization of certain documents that can accrue additional cost, and more importantly, in many cases, result in additional time pressure. So it's very common, in my experience, that folks will be very excited about getting a patent application filed, port that out, we'll send an array of formal docs, including assignments. And right before a deadline where we need those assignments, we'll have a bit of a scramble to maybe get those folks who may or may not still be at the company to sign those things. And so we really always recommend signing them quickly, especially if you're including ex-US rights, because there can be a little additional complication. In addition, the content of the assignment and how you do that matters. Particularly, again, outside the United States, in Europe, for example, the right to claim priority is a separate right. It's distinct from the ownership of the application. And so the document that affects the transfer or the assignment needs to include the right to claim priority. And in some cases, you can't even rely on the employment agreements I mentioned before. They may or may not be sufficient to transfer ownership, but oftentimes the right to claim priority is different. And then in some jurisdictions, there are also moral rights or other types of rights that can attach and need to be accounted for when you're transferring rights, not just ownership rights. That's the whole point. Sometimes there is more than that. An additional complication that I've seen many times has to do with cases that are owned by more than one party. So joint ownership, right? Jointly owned cases. In those cases, you need to be really, really careful, especially again, outside the United States, because what you can do with a jointly owned case, despite contract describing certain features of the relationship can be limited. So in certain jurisdictions in Europe, for example, you're not allowed to license out a jointly owned piece of intellectual property without written permission sometimes, or just permission from the other joint owners. Sometimes you have to give a financial accounting too, sometimes you don't. But the point is, if it's a jointly owned case, just take that extra moment, pay a little bit of extra attention, because you want to make sure that whatever you contemplate doing with that asset is something that you actually can do. And the last feature, this is really related to ownership and assignment in the United States in particular, but it has to do with government rights. And so many patent applications that are put together include some form of government sponsorship, so academic labs, grants, those sorts of things. If you use federal funding, in most cases, you then are agreeing to grant a license to the U.S. government to use that invention. It also comes with a few other features, such as you're supposed to manufacture in the United States, absent securing a waiver, which some folks forget to do or think they don't need to. But that is a box that you need to check and something you need to think about. And then theoretically, although it has never been exercised thus far, there are march-in rights that the U.S. government gets when that funding is used. And so interestingly, recently, we've had a couple clients who are not based in the U.S. have used U.S. grant money to do some of their work. And so this is kind of a big shocker, can be, that the government can get rights. So definitely something to keep in mind.
Thanks, Brian. That leads us to a topic that I know you have particular expertise in, IP-related transactions. What are some cross-border related issues you've seen crop up in such transactions?
Yeah, thanks, John. This is getting increasing in frequency, I think, the cross-border nature of a lot of these transactions, be they licensing agreements or more deep sort of research collaboration agreements. And many times what we'll see is a client is at a particular state of the business. They have their pipeline, they have their lead or leads, and they know what they need to do in the jurisdiction in which they're based. But they're not sure how to commercialize outside that jurisdiction. So for a U.S.-based company, they're not sure how to commercialize in China in many cases, right? And so one of the things that I've seen, especially at the term sheet stage, you'll see clients plan for what they're doing now and what they want to do in their jurisdiction. They don't think about what happens if the company's wildly successful and grows, or what if it's acquired? What is a potential acquirer going to look for? Would they have sufficient rights to commercialize as broadly as they may want to? And so the right answer is not always try to keep worldwide rights or put in, you know, draconian reversion rights, but it is something that you want to keep in mind that it's you're signing the agreement today, which is a great thing, but the business is going to change tomorrow. So you just really want to plan for that. So some of the common questions that you want to ask are, which jurisdictions are you looking to either partner or license out or otherwise encumber? Is it one nation? Is it an array of nations? Is there a way to step up so that the geography expands or could be expanded by the counterparty or by yourself? And can you get those rights back if you need to? They're all common mechanisms for doing those things, but you want to make sure that you include the ones that may be applicable for you in the future. An additional common one is, can you or can the counterparty sublicense the rights that are being discussed? That is very, very common. And it's also commonly forgotten until it's an emergency. You're about to sign a deal for distribution in jurisdiction X. And you find out you can't actually sublicense to another entity. And you have to go back and you have to get permission for that. And that's not a great time to be having that conversation. So you really want to pay close attention to sublicensing provisions up front. And then, as we touched on in session one, you want to map your IP rights and your filing strategy to your product flow, where you're making the product, where you anticipate folks using it. And so you want to make sure that the licensed rights also are consistent with that flow. Another factor that can influence the structure of a variety of different deals is your corporate structure, actually. So whether you're an LLC or a C-Corp in the U.S. or whatever your entity may be outside the U.S., you might need to actually sublicense to other entities in the corporate tree, depending on how you're structured. And so that is something that you want to pay attention to and talk to your BD folks or your outside counsel and think about. Just because entity X, the parent entity, has rights doesn't necessarily mean that all the subsidiaries get those rights too. So you just want to make sure that T is crossed as you're negotiating your document. And then the last major thing to consider is that when you're signing a cross-border deal, this may be obvious, but there are differences in national laws, right? In contract interpretation, how certain language is usually interpreted can be very, very different. And the other thing is, if there's intellectual property that may be invoked under this agreement, you raise all the issues we had in session one and the ones we talked about here. Who owns it? What can you do with it? Are there government rights? Do we need a foreign filing licenses, right, in order to be able to file our application? How are we going to enforce this thing? Are there joint owners? All of those things play in. And so one of the provisions I've seen really glossed over many times is the choice of governing law. And it can be absolutely critical, similar reasons to the reasons that the enforcement varies so much, right? The national laws can be very, very different, sometimes in ways that are really positive for you, some ways that aren't. So you need to be very, very careful of that. And then the last little feature of the governing law and just the cross-border nature of what we're talking about has to do with export control laws. And so depending on what information has to go where and whom the parties are, you may run afoul of some of these export control laws. So it's always a good idea to check with an expert on those as well. So those are the topics we wanted to cover today in session two. So we thank you for your attention here. I think John and I really want to reinforce that in all of these discussions, it's really about running the business and helping patients if you're in the life sciences sector. That's priority one, and it really needs to be. You know, sometimes clients get bogged down a little bit in the technical nature of either the IP-related transactions, patent filing strategy, and it can get in the way where they think they have to do extra experimental work, for instance, to support a patent application. And we always try to guide folks back to, it's about the business. It's about getting your treatment to patients. Everything else should be supportive of that effort.
That's right, Brian. And as we've covered on this and the prior episode, there are unfortunately many ways to waste time, resources, or even forfeit rights or exclusivity if careful attention isn't paid while planning for expansion or partnerships. Thanks to everyone for listening. Hope you enjoyed the session. And stay tuned for our additional sessions soon.
For more information, please visit www.choate.com. You can also listen to additional podcast episodes in the newsroom of our website and subscribe to them wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. The information presented in this recording is for educational purposes only. It does not constitute legal advice for a specific situation. If you wish to obtain legal advice, you should retain an attorney and explain the facts of your particular situation.